He had stood on the soil that gave that idea birth. He had seen the landscape that had given the world the Exodus story. He had seen the ancient roots of his own history. He could feel some mystical sense of being an American Joseph. During these first months back in Washington after the foreign tour, and beneath these high moments of public storytelling, tragedy struck Douglas's extended family again. During a 2-week period in November, 5 more of Douglas's grandchildren died, all apparently in a typhoid fever epidemic. On November 2nd, Charles Frederick Douglas, oldest son of Charles and Libby, died at 21 years old. The next day, Julia Ada Douglas, daughter of Charles, died at 14. By the middle of the month, Charles and Libby lost 2 more children, Edward and Anne Elizabeth. And on November 14th, Gertrude Pearl Douglas, daughter of Frederick Jr. and his wife Virginia, died at only 4 years old. This marked the deaths of 6 grandchildren over just a year and a half. All were given funerals from Cedar Hill and buried in Graceland Cemetery. In large families, death could seem omnipresent in the 19th century. During his lifetime, Douglas saw 10 of his grandchildren die of disease. For Frederick Jr. and Charles, these personal losses were devastating. By late summer of 1887, Frederick Jr. had lost his job at the recorder's office and was taking loans from his father and his brothers. His financial story was nearly as tragic as his family's loss by death. In December 1890, Frederick Jr.'s wife, Virginia Hewlett Douglas, died at age 41 of what obituaries called consumption. At her death, Virginia's brother, Emmanuel Molyneux Hewlett, took custody of the couple's 2 remaining children, Charles Paul and Robert Smalls Douglas. How Douglas himself coped with all these personal losses that autumn, or during the final 2 decades of his life, he did not tell us. Having Helen always at his side had to be crucial and bracing, however tepid her relationships with the adult Douglas children. These family tragedies may partly explain why the old orator took so assiduously to the lecture circuit and to the political stump. In 1888, in a new political season, Douglas, the traveling man, soon re-entered the fray, in the press and on the road. Before their father arrived back in Washington in 1887, Lewis and Frederick Douglass Jr. both took to public platforms to condemn blacks who would change parties and support Democrats. By October and November, the elder Douglass resumed bitter press exchanges with his critics, especially those who advocated that blacks divide their loyalties between the 2 political parties for leverage. To Douglass, this scheme was absurd, even madness. He engaged in a particularly nasty exchange throughout November in the New York Age with T. McCants Stewart, an AME minister and lawyer, 35 years younger than Douglas, who had spent 2 years teaching in Liberia and who advocated that the race consider joining the Democrats. Douglas would have none of it. "It is far better that all our ventures should be in a sound ship than to have any part of them in a ship that is unseaworthy." Even more directly, he pulled out the old bloody shirts. "I find that every shotgun aimed at the breast of a Negro at the South today is leveled by the hand of a Democrat. That every Negro strung up at the crossroads without judge or jury is so strung up by a Democratic mob. That every effort to defeat and annul the 14th and 15th Amendments is made by Democrats." Douglas even wrote bloody shirt letters to Republican state leaders in New York. On February 28, 1888, at Metropolitan AME in Washington, which became a kind of home church and public pulpit for Douglas, a huge gathering, including some congressmen, celebrated what they assumed was the famous man's 71st birthday. The guest of honor embraced the occasion, although in his speech he reminded the audience that he had never had a birthday. Douglas told listeners, "We slaves were born at times, harvest times, watermelon times, and generally hard times." For Douglas, the occasion was about the power of the past, a chance to embrace living memory and to make slavery that story never forgotten for the many children attending. "They used to tell me up in New England not to refer to the stripes on my back. But when I remembered that such a great man as Paul had told of the stripes he had received, I thought, why should a little fellow like me be ashamed to acknowledge that I had been flogged? In this shared sense of suffering lay Douglas's personal affinity with the prisoner apostle. Douglas insisted on remembrance before any action. Perhaps there is too much past, but remember that all the present rests on all the past. Remember is as good a word as forget. The next day, he hit the rails for a speaking tour of South Carolina and Georgia. In the late 1880s, a journey into the Deep South for such a conspicuous African-American man was not without danger. Douglas went to lecture, but also to see firsthand the conditions of the freed people after almost a quarter century of freedom and its denial. In the cradle of the Confederacy, Charleston, the storied city of secession, and the entrepot of so many African Americans and their ancestors as slaves into the United States, Douglas gave two lectures at the Mount Zion Church. Often called the daughter church of Mother Emanuel AME, Mount Zion was opened for worship in 1883. Its first minister, the Reverend Norman B. Starrett, was a former Union soldier. Douglas delivered versions of Self-Made Men and of the European Travels addresses. He was given a carriage ride around the old city of Charleston, much of it still being rebuilt since the war, and was met by a black militia unit calling itself the Douglas Light Infantry. Just what Douglas thought of the charms and haunts of Charleston, he did not tell us. One press report indicated that the large audience may have wanted to hear more from the great orator on the racial conditions in the South than about his pursuit of the racial character of Egyptians. Douglas found that the Egyptian, if not a Negro, could pass for one in the United States. He was of a color between that of a new saddle and that of an old one. He was of a mixed race, very much like some seen all around us. Douglas moved on to speak to large black audiences in Augusta, Georgia, where a local, embittered lost cause advocate lampooned him. "When it comes to degrading and debasing myself at the feet of a thick-lipped nigger demagogue," wrote Indies, "a sense of decency compels me to say to the white people of this community, leave my part of the freedom of the city when the keys are handed over to the Honorable Frederick Douglass." Here was the irreconcilable divide in the South since the war, embodied in the presence of the country's most famous black man. Douglas was no mere carpetbagger. He was to the local Augustine the political firebrand thrown into our midst. As in the old abolitionist tours of the 1840s in the North, Douglas relished this role of the hated outsider speaking truth to power as long as he was not killed in the effort. That year, an estimated 137 lynchings occurred across the country, most in the Deep South. Among the places Douglas spoke in Augusta was the Ware High School for Blacks. The setting was decked out in flowers and a big sign in golden letters, "Welcome." Beneath an easel were pictures of Ulysses Grant, Abraham Lincoln, Blanche Bruce, and Douglas. A program with students reading excerpts from Life and Times, according to local press, left the guest of honor conspicuously listening as tears glistened in his eyes. Douglas traveled back into South Carolina, lecturing in Orangeburg, where he was verbally attacked for discussing equality of the races. He returned northward by mid-March, full of impressions of the South, which he soon examined in public speeches. En route, he was Jim Crowed in Weldon, North Carolina, as the train stopped and he was not allowed to eat in a local restaurant. In Washington, on April 16th, the annual anniversary celebration of D.C. emancipation once again occurred amid controversy. Whether to have raucous parades and just where black political allegiances best lay led to two separate keynote addresses, one by Douglas at the Fourth Baptist Church and one by his rival, John Mercer Langston, at the Asbury Methodist Episcopal Church. Douglas rode in a carriage at the front of a long procession of militia units, floats, and bands. In his speech, Douglas addressed the conditions and violence in the lives of the freedmen. What he'd learned in South Carolina and Georgia was not favorable to my hopes for the race. He acknowledged that anniversaries are often devoted to prophecy of smooth things, the joyful and glad, But on this occasion, he told a dark story, whether people found it tasteful or not. There are times when neither hope nor fear should be allowed to control our speech, he declared, and sought tone and justification in Isaiah. Cry aloud and spare not. Douglas was back to playing his old antebellum role of the Jeremiah. Above all, his address in April 1888 was a diatribe against the Democratic Party, as a new kind of slave power conspiracy intending to seize the powers of the federal government to sustain white supremacy and crush the liberties of blacks. He portrayed the nation's condition as a struggle over memory. Well, may it be said that Americans have no memories. We look over the House of Representatives and see the solid South enthroned there. We listen with calmness to eulogies of traitors and forget Andersonville. We look over the Senate and see the senator from South Carolina, and we forget Hamburg, a massacre of blacks in 1876. African Americans, Douglas maintained, had a special responsibility to make the nation remember the deepest meanings of the Civil War and emancipation. Well, the nation may forget. It may shut its eyes to the past. But the colored people of this country are bound to keep fresh a memory of the past till justice shall be done them in the present. However difficult, Douglas asked his people to shoulder this long-term burden. The victim of a cunningly devised swindle, the sharecropping system, the plantation Negro in the South, was worse off than when a slave, Douglas maintained. Freedmen farmers were, in the orator's view, systematically cheated out of fair wages and of land. They were like a man in a morass. The more he struggles, the deeper he sinks. This satanic arrangement, as Douglas termed the Southern agricultural system and its new labor relations, especially through landlord and tenant laws, had buried the freedmen in a dead end of debt and tenancy. Some in the press attacked Douglas for his harsh rhetoric in this speech. The Washington Bee thought the address a mere scarecrow to cover up more positive realities. But other papers, such as the Boston Morning Journal, considered the speech a staggering blow to the pleasing fiction of a new regenerated South. To all those 21st century Republicans, desperate to find African-American heroes and adherents in their long-ago past, Douglas left this statement of his real views on the nature of government. I know it is said that the general government is a government of limited powers. It was also once said that the national government could not coerce a state. But whenever an administration has had the will to do anything, it has generally found constitutional power to do it. Douglas drew on sacred memory and experience rooted in the federal power exercised to free the slaves in war and deliver them rights in a new constitution. If the general government had the power to make black men citizens, he sternly declared, it has the power to protect them in that citizenship. If it had the right to make them voters, it has the right to protect them in the exercise of the elective franchise. As Douglas condemned Democrats, he also challenged his own party to embody a new departure in which it would remember its storied past and use federal power to stem the bloody tide in the South and to win new victories in 1888 at the ballot box. Enough of shaking hands over the bloody chasm, Douglas shouted. Enough of conciliation. Enough of laudation of the bravery of our Southern brethren. There was no honor to be found among ex-Confederates. Douglas demanded of Republicans a politics of confrontation before it was too late. The old lion had found a new roar and was ready to take it out on the stump. Douglas attended the Republican National Convention in Chicago in June, not as a delegate, but essentially as the celebrity symbol he had become for his party. Tall and conspicuous, standing at the rear of the stage at the Chicago Armory on the convention's first day, he was, as usual, called on to speak by a swelling chorus from the thousands attending. Douglas, Douglas, the old familiar appeal rolled over the room. Douglas later admitted that he preferred Senator John Sherman of Ohio as the presidential candidate, but acquiesced in the nomination of Benjamin Harrison of Indiana. With a reputation as a moderate, Harrison had nevertheless supported radical Reconstruction. He had also risen from lieutenant to brigade commander in a distinguished record as a soldier during the war. So the orator played off that story in his brief, one that he claimed was not to tickle men's ears or to flatter party pride. He appealed to Republicans to act on their commitment to black rights and security, because when Abraham Lincoln called upon the Negro in the crisis of war, he, the black man, reached forth with his iron arm and caught with his steel fingers your faltering flag. And he came. He came full 200,000 strong. The partisan throng loved it. Now those same men in the South were compelled to wade to the ballot box through blood. In these images of flag, blood, sacrifice, and military glory, Douglas demanded that his party live up to its historic promises. As he ended, the crowd of delegates cheered wildly and shouted, "Douglas! Douglas!" So taken was the Chicago Tribune with Douglas's appearance at the convention that it printed two drawings of him, one speaking and the other holding the gavel. By August, Douglas resumed his ugly rivalry with John Mercer Langston, who was running for Congress from the heavily black 4th District of Virginia. Douglas opposed Langston's candidacy on the grounds that he was insufficiently loyal to the Republican Party. The Sage of Cedar Hill exposed his insider status in the party by sidestepping this historic chance to see a black congressman from a state such as Virginia. Instead, he supported William Mahoney, a former Confederate, although much changed, and now the Republicans' veritable party boss. Mahoney would not step aside, forcing Langston to run as an independent. Douglas's public and personal disavowal of Langston brought a wave of criticism, even from old friends. T. Thomas Fortune in the New York Age accused Douglas of a vain sacrifice of race to the fetish of party and personal pique. The Washington Bee claimed the dispute was pure personal animosity on Douglas's part, and that the old leader dislikes to see others succeed. It got worse, with some papers calling on Mrs. Douglas to step in and bring the old man to his senses. The family found itself dragged into the mud. Charles went to the press with a public letter defending his father and attacking Langston, even as Nathan Sprague condemned his father-in-law for not supporting the black candidate. Feuds occurred within feuds. Douglas wrote a long letter of defense that someone should have told him to scrap. It rather lamely made the old case for the Republican Party as the sheet anchor for black political hopes. He trotted out long quotations demonstrating the white supremacist desires of Democrats to eliminate blacks from American life. He further claimed that Langston's candidacy was staked solely on color and not principle. Color, in this instance, Douglas argued, carried no moral or political quality. The solidity of the Republican Party was at stake. He even attacked Langston, who had served 7 years as U.S. Minister to Haiti, personally for past political sins, especially his advocacy that blacks divide their votes between the parties. Langston lost a close election, but after a 2-year legal challenge to the fraud practiced by the Democrats in Virginia to win the election, he was seated by Congress in 1890 and served the last 3 months of the term. This entire affair embarrassed Douglas. A supreme irony of such a bitter relationship is that the two men agreed on many crucial issues, such as federal supervision of voting in the South, integrated education, and enforcement of civil rights based on the 14th Amendment. Douglas simply was not good at forgetting. In the fall campaign, reluctant as he was about Harrison, Douglas took the stump in at least 5 states, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Michigan, and Indiana. "There comes a time," he wrote in Life and Times, "when in every election, the judgment of factions must yield to the judgment of the majority." How agonizingly he had learned this lesson over and again, at least since 1856. In 1888, the Democrats ran incumbent Grover Cleveland, this time on a platform of free trade and denunciation of the longtime protective tariff policies of the Republicans. Harrison and the Republicans tried to focus their campaign squarely on the tariff. Protection became all but a moral claim to saving American profits and workers at the same time. Neither party much addressed the race and violence question in the South. Douglas admitted that he felt almost too old for the daily speaking demands of an election tour. But he also stressed, as he did in New Haven, Connecticut, in October, that he did not want the Republican effort confined to a single issue, though that be a grand economical question. In his stump speeches for Harrison, Douglas made his half-hearted arguments for the national tariff, but demanded more from the idea of protection. The parties, declared Douglas to a packed house in the Hyperion Theater near Yale University, represented two opposite ideas. Ideological political warfare had formerly been a matter of bullets versus the ballot. But now, the two great ideas were one, born of slavery, of class dominion, and the other, born of liberty, of the respectability of labor. Democrats were afraid of the past, Douglas asserted. Republicans should embrace and use it. He offered a new party slogan few, if any, adopted. I am for protection because I am for civilization. In an extremely close election, Cleveland won the popular vote by about 100,000 votes, 5,540,309 to 5,439,853, but lost in the Electoral College, 233 to 168. Harrison carried virtually all of New England, all of the Midwest, the Great Plains, and the far western states. Cleveland states, exclusively the Solid South, were insufficient to win a general election at this point in the Gilded Age. A Republican was going back to the White House with a geographically expanded Yankee vote. In early January 1889, Douglas gave a newspaper interview at Cedar Hill. When the journalist arrived, the host was practicing on his violin. The two had a wide-ranging conversation about the scale of suppression of the black vote in the recent election, but also about Douglas's excitement about a Republican return to power. He expressed the sunny faith that now the American people are to have one country, one law, one liberty, and a common destiny. As the interview ended, Douglas took up his violin, saying goodbye by playing the Star-Spangled Banner for his guest. As a surrogate who had labored hard for the Republican ticket, Douglas would be given a significant reward by President Harrison, if he chose to take it. But before that happened, in the winter and spring of 1889, Douglas made a second speaking tour of the Deep South. On February 4th, 1889, just as he arrived in Little Rock, Arkansas, Douglas sent a postcard to Helen. All right, I'm among friends. Shall speak here tomorrow eve, somewhat worn by 2 days and 2 nights' travel. After 2 weeks of lectures in at least 3 Arkansas cities and then several in Kansas, Douglas rode the cars back home to Washington. He was still making these trips and delivering self-made men and other speeches for money. People flocked to see Old Man Eloquent, especially in places where he had never before appeared. Douglas was an icon of a kind in American civil religion, both a ghost-like figure of the bygone era of slavery and the war, as well as the living voice about the ever-dominant race question in the present. In the first week of April, Douglas took the trains south again. In March, newspapers reported that the traveling man had committed to be the guest of honor at the Jacksonville, Florida, Subtropical Exposition. When his train stopped in Savannah, Georgia, a crowd of blacks, led by a black military company, gathered to see and greet the famous leader. The train stayed only about half an hour, reported a local paper, but it was time enough for Old Man Eloquent to come out and greet the gathering. He begged off from making a speech, but reviewed the militia unit. The train rolled out of the depot amid loud cheering. Within a stone's throw of one of the largest cotton trading centers in the South, and in a city with thousands of black freedmen struggling to survive and live meaningful lives amid hostile white supremacy festering around each of its beautiful squares, the locals had only glimpsed their mysterious hero. Douglas's extraordinary arrival amid huge crowds in Jacksonville was news even in the North. Excursion trains full of black folk from southern Georgia and all over northern and central Florida filled Jacksonville with an estimated 20,000 visitors. 2 trains, organized in Bainbridge, Georgia, charged $3 per person for the 2 days' journey. Some arrived by foot, and some riding mules. A procession said to be over a mile long led Douglas, riding in a carriage, into the exposition grounds. Perhaps no other such assemblage of black people had ever occurred so openly in the Deep South. The Florida Times Union called Douglas the most historic character in the checkered history of black Americans. The white reporter was astonished at how the colored people had the right of way in the streets, dressed in all manner of gay clothing, and filling the streets as a moving mass of picturesque humanity. The journalist seemed both fearful and impressed with such turbulent exuberance of a tropical race. A band played at the station and at every stop Douglas made. It was April. Flowers were everywhere. Douglas's reception was almost that of a visiting head of state. At the main exposition building, a double line of people escorted him down a central aisle with the band blaring. He stepped up onto a pedestal richly decorated by magnolia leaves and choice flowers, the floor being carpeted by cut flowers. Douglas sat on a chair and received a line of local dignitaries who came to shake his hand. A line of light-complexioned teenage black girls, all dressed in white, also presented themselves, each representing one of the American states. After a couple hours of rest for the orator of the day, the crowds gathered at a grandstand to hear the patriarch's speech, as the reporter called it. According to a young black man who helped with the introduction of Douglas, the old orator had arrived in the top rank of the American pantheon. "We have always learned in our schools," said Joseph E. Lee, "that the one who gave liberty to our country was George Washington. The one who will always be known as the savior of his country is Ulysses S. Grant. But we have one of our own race who is as great as the greatest, one who carved his way from darkness into light. This man is Honorable Frederick Douglass." After more pomp and introductions, one by the distinguished AME Bishop Daniel Alexander Payne, Douglas finally took the lectern, smiling amid deafening applause. He used some of his old self-effacing jokes. He feared he could only offer his poor job-trot eloquence compared to the good bishop's. Douglas's address, only one among several he was asked to give at the exposition, was a vintage combination of post-emancipation hope and progress with Jeremiadic warnings about the fragile nature of black freedom. Sometimes, speaking in a southern black dialect, he wrapped his message in occasional self-deprecating humor, as well as laughs gained at the expense of the old masters. Douglas stressed the vast and wonderful change since the 1860s. He marveled that he could live to see the day when I could with safety to my person, to my liberty, tread the soil of Florida, of South Carolina, of Georgia. For so long, the very names of those states sent a shudder through me. But now, Douglas declared via Isaiah, we see a new heaven and a new earth. Many whites were in the audience that day as well, and the guest orator drew them in. Even the old masters shall rejoice that they are liberated in our deliverance. But Douglas urged the freedmen and their sons and daughters to not overrate their progress. He urged remembrance of the blood and terror in the crucible of emancipation. They had not been emancipated by moral convictions, but in the tempest and whirlwind of civil rebellion. Then, in a refrain, he argued that blacks had not been freed so much as turned loose to the open sky. Turned loose. Douglas roared to the rear of the huge crowd. But he left this celebratory crowd laughing. He told of how the old masters desperately needed their black laborers and begged them to come back after 1865. They found they had sent away the hands and left the mouths. They had sent away the muscle and had left the stomachs. He chided any old slaveholders present about their naming habits for their slaves. "Come back, Pompey. Come back, Caesar," Douglas shouted in mimicry of the former master class. "How honored blacks should have been," he said mockingly, "that slaveholders never called us by any other than those great names of the Greeks." He further ridiculed the old idea that with freedom, blacks would begin to die out as a race. "If slavery could not kill us," Liberty will not, he announced to great laughter and cheering. Douglas broke into dialect to proclaim how blacks and whites must learn to live with one another. Speaking to whites, he said, Brethren, I has been with you, and is still with you, and mean to be with you till the end. But as entertainer, he was not finished. To show how blacks should be measured from the depths from which we came, Douglas gave the howling audience almost a piece of minstrelsy, at least as portrayed by a reporter. Did you ever think of a man like myself, who has grown up to weigh 235 pounds, that I have had to fight with a dog named Nep under my master's table for crumbs of bread? Well, I did. I had to skirmish with old Nep for a share of the Johnny cakes. I used to fight for them, and now, my friends, see how fat I am. The following day, Douglas spoke again, this time a speech called The Lessons of the Hour, in which he condemned all talk of a Negro problem. As he had so often before, he declared such a problem the nation's dilemma with racism, and not with his race. On that day, Douglas met a 79-year-old former slave who approached him to say that they had been companions in bondage near St. Michael's on the Eastern Shore. But the most remarkable member of Douglas's audiences in Jacksonville was the future poet, novelist, songwriter, and civil rights leader, James Weldon Johnson. The 17-year-old native of the town, in his later autobiography, Along This Way, remembered seeing and hearing Douglas with great reverence. For a teenager who would later leave such an enduring mark on African-American letters and leadership, this encounter with the great Douglas was transcendent. Johnson had not only heard a great deal about Douglas while growing up. As a child at the Stanton Grammar School, he had won a book as a prize, The Life and Times of Frederick Douglass. Johnson said he read the autobiography with feverish intensity, and that he looked forward to the former slaves coming to Jacksonville with more than the glamorous curiosity with which he had looked forward to the coming of General Grant. He wanted to hear him speak and catch his words. But like all others, Johnson never forgot seeing Douglas. No one could ever forget the first sight of Frederick Douglass, Johnson lyrically wrote. A tall, straight, magnificent man with a lion-like head covered with a glistening white mane, who instantly called forth in one form or another Napoleon's exclamation when he first saw Goethe, Behold, a man. Johnson's tribute left no doubt about a long-term inspiration that many in the Floridian's generation felt for their intellectual ancestor. As I watched and listened to him, Johnson said, for a half-century the unafraid champion of freedom and equality of his race, I was filled with a feeling of worshipful awe. He did catch some of Douglas's memorable words. In particular, he recalled the sage's response to a question about his second marriage, a statement Johnson claimed no one in his own time of the 1930s would dare to make. He recollected Douglas saying that in his first marriage, he paid compliments to his mother's race, and in his second marriage, to the race of his father. For the man who would write the complex and haunting novel, Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, in which racial passing plays a powerful, ironic role, and who had worked so long with the NAACP, for a racially integrated vision of America, those words no doubt had staying power. After the festival in Jacksonville, on his journey north, Douglas stopped to speak to freedmen in Thomasville, Georgia. There, he again delivered stern advice about self-reliance to an audience of freedmen and had some exchanges in dialect. One black farmer kept interrupting the speaker with, "That's so." Before leaving Thomasville, Douglas went to a local bank and had his host convert the honorarium check from $150 down to $125, because the night's proceeds did not cover the full fee. The wandering lecturer arrived back in Washington to deliver his usual annual address on April 16th, D.C. Emancipation Day. In that effort, fraught with controversy again and much attacked by some black papers, Douglas used his recent Southern tour to argue forcefully that blacks in the former Confederacy were in dire danger for their rights and their lives. He also sought to banish the idea of a Negro problem. To Douglas, this question was always and everywhere the great national problem. Douglas could still command fees for lecturing, and invitations poured in, but he was once again looking for a steady job. Back on March 7th, between his two southern tours, he wrote a carefully worded letter of application to the newly inaugurated President Harrison, seeking his old office as recorder of deeds. That would not work out. But another, perhaps more glamorous and dramatic appointment, one he had already explored for some time, appeared on the foreign horizon. Some in the black press attacked Douglas again as an office seeker out for his own fame and fortune. By late June, Harrison named the 71-year-old Douglas U.S. Minister to Haiti. Soon, he traveled on a steamer yet again on the deep blue sea, this time into a diplomatic quagmire. Chapter 30. Haiti, Servant Between Two Masters. A man must defend himself, if only to demonstrate his fitness to defend anything else. Frederick Douglass, 1891. Douglass had been part of numerous racial firsts in his life, but this was not one of them. The position as minister and consul general to Haiti had been treated as a designated black assignment in the Foreign Service since the Grant administration. Douglass's old friend, Ebenezer Bassett, and Douglass's arch-rival, John Mercer Langston, had both served long terms in the post. Langston served with distinction from 1877 to 1885. Douglass and Bassett had first met in the younger man's hometown of New Haven, Connecticut, in 1855. Bassett had been primarily a career diplomat. His stint as U.S. minister in Haiti, 1869 to 77, ended less than successfully as he landed on the wrong side of a Haitian civil conflict. Bassett and Douglass communicated frequently in the months leading up to the old abolitionist's appointment as minister. They had reconnected during the 1888 campaign, as Douglass spoke in New Haven. The two men also shared family connections and memories. Bassett and his wife, Eliza, had named a son, Frederick Douglass Bassett, who died in his youth in Port-au-Prince. The sage of Cedar Hill would have preferred to stay home and resume his old job as recorder of deeds, but President Harrison and his Secretary of State, James G. Blaine, had other plans for the most famous black Republican. In 1889, Haiti was emerging from yet another civil war in its turbulent history. The appointment was therefore fraught with controversy over the character of U.S. interests in the Caribbean, and of particular concern to New York merchants with keen eyes on Haiti's resources and steamship lines. From the beginning of his appointment to the Haiti position until well after it ended, Douglass served as a diplomatic spokesman, sometimes for both countries, explaining one to the other, as well as with ever-escalating self-justification. His Haitian sojourn, a difficult and exhausting interlude in an aging and unhealthy man's life, was anything but a diplomatic success. But it led Douglass to a new level of international and Atlantic consciousness, and to some degree, even racial consciousness. Douglass's appointment as minister and consul general to Haiti in the summer of 1889 received both rave and critical reviews in the press, initiating the roller coaster of controversy to follow. The New York Tribune admired the appointment, although reminded readers that the venerable and yet active and vigorous Douglass was 72 years old. Initially, the New York Herald thought Douglass's appointment would bring universal satisfaction because of his stature and because he was above suspicion regarding the influence of wealthy American merchants. The New York press believed Douglass, because of race kinship with Haitians, would make a permanent pacificator of that perturbed republic. Many black papers celebrated this elevation once again for the lion of the colored people. The New York World overmatched all other hyperbole, although possibly tongue-in-cheek. The Haitians will doubtless quit fighting when they hear that Mr. Douglass is coming to live among them. Some of this rhetoric showed only how little most Americans knew about Haiti. Somewhat more informed, the Washington Post nevertheless belittled the appointment, suggesting that Douglass had favored coercion and annexation of Santo Domingo when serving the 1871 commission under Grant. Douglass responded with a vigorous defense of himself and of Haiti, Harrison's appointment likely was not a thoughtless reward to a party loyalist, as a previous biographer suggested. But the new minister stood ready to protect his own honor as well as Haiti's history. Like many other African-American intellectuals of the 19th century, Douglass had long admired the transcendent Haitian revolutionary leader Toussaint Louverture. Douglass and his sons had contributed to Toussaint's mythic place among Black Americans by purchasing hundreds of pictures of the former slave general to use for publicity during the final 2 years, 1873 to 74, of publication of the New National Era. By 1889, Douglass maintained a significant distinction between coercion and annexation. There had been a good argument, export of American abolitionist ideals to a desperate Caribbean country, he said, for annexing Santo Domingo without military force during Reconstruction. He especially claimed for Haiti an important place in the future of the colored man on this continent. He believed Haiti was unfairly maligned as evidence that Black people could not govern themselves. Haiti's recurring revolutions represented the process of evolution, not of decay or retrogression. He urged post-readers to bury their racism and remember that France had experienced 12 revolutions in a century, and that the United States had only recently risen from a tempest and whirlwind of civil war, as wild, persistent, and turbulent as anything Haiti had experienced. Such bold words soon ran headlong into the silencing scriptures of diplomatic office. But first, Douglass had to endure the usual slamming from his Black enemies at the Washington Bee and the New York Sun. Harrison had rewarded Old Man Eloquent whether, according to the Sun, the chronic office holder needed employment or not. Worse, the Sun editor accused Douglass once again of nepotism in seeking federal appointments for his soon-to-be grandson-in-law, Charles S. Morris, who was still a college student. Annie Sprague, Rosetta's 24-year-old daughter, married Morris, who did not get a Foreign Service position, and moved to Ann Arbor, Michigan, to attend college. The Cleveland Gazette wished that Douglass had stepped aside for the more deserving and more intelligent young man of the race. A younger Republican, the paper contended, was not a blind follower of Frederick Douglass. The critics were ever awaiting any misstep. By late August, with Douglass's departure postponed because of the uncertain military situation on the island, the New York Herald changed its tune and urged the U.S. State Department to send a white man to such a sensitive post, since, if there is anything the average Haitian loathes, it is a mulatto, and worse, Douglass was a pronounced mulatto married to a white woman. By September and October, when Frederick and Helen did depart, the New York Times and the Herald ran stories with rumors that Douglass's appointment was to be scuttled. These reports were likely the machinations of New York merchants who desired a different U.S. envoy, one who might accommodate their interests. An elaborate ceremony at Metropolitan AME Church in Washington, at which Douglass was presented with the departure gift of a special Bible, likely assuaged some of the negative press coverage. The pastor honored the new minister's acceptance of the appointment in his old age, comparing him to Moses and Joshua, who were said to be over 80. After news that certain naval officers refused to sail with the interracial couple on board, the Douglasses finally embarked for Port-au-Prince on October 12th, aboard the famous Civil War battleship the Kearsarge. The former slave from the Tuckahoe had again managed, through thick and thin, to climb another historical height. He would soon find out whether he wanted to be there at all. Rumors flew that Douglass had been assigned to Haiti with instructions to negotiate annexation of the country, and especially to secure a U.S. naval station at Môle Saint-Nicolas, with its splendid harbor on the island's northwest coast. At least the second rumor was true, although it took time to evolve as a diplomatic strategy. Helen willingly accompanied her husband on this new journey to the tropics, although their interracial marriage was not easy to negotiate in the diplomatic social environment of Port-au-Prince. The flowers would be beautiful, the climate rough. Joining Douglass also was Ebenezer Bassett, who had in professional desperation begged the new minister to take him along as his personal secretary. Bassett spoke French, which Douglas did not, and the former minister had valuable knowledge of Haiti's labyrinthine political landscape. "I know them, Haitians," Bassett wrote to Douglas, "their language and their inspirations, just as you know the people of the District of Columbia." Douglas needed Bassett as well to prepare him for the apparent transition of power. After bloody insurrection and war, from François Légitime's regime to that of the new ruler, General Floville Hippolyte, the situation was fluid and violent in Haiti. As Douglas's departure was officially delayed, he relied on Bassett's experience and advice. On the idea of an American coaling station at Mont Saint-Nicolas, Bassett urged great caution. "Haitians generally are very sensitive to this matter of losing their autonomy," Bassett instructed in one of his letters, which he always labeled confidential. "It is one subject in which they all agree." The American scheme of gaining a naval station and greater commerce on Haitian soil would be relentless, Bassett warned. But he believed the two of them, as a team, could face the music and hold our own in the diplomatic dance around the Haitian plum when once we are on the scene. The scene in Port-au-Prince was hot, slow-moving, and politically delicate. Upon his arrival in Haiti on October 15th, and for some weeks afterward, Douglas wrote to Secretary of State Blaine about the order and tranquility in the capital, and about how Hippolyte had just been unanimously elected by the Constituent Assembly and inaugurated amid demonstrations of popular confidence. "Every Haitian he met," said Douglas, "had had enough of war and is willing now to acquiesce in a condition of peace." But he was anxious to get his letter of credence to present to the new president. Otherwise, he seems to have felt like a diplomat without portfolio or a functioning legation. With Bassett's assistance and from his own reading and correspondence, Douglas slowly became aware of the deeper context for his immediate challenge. As a scholar of Haiti has suggested, Harrison's appointment of Douglas had been carefully managed to put a distinguished black American in the role of negotiating deals already long in the making. Harrison, and especially Blaine, were advocates of a foreign policy of Pan-Americanism, the idea of ever-expanding commercial networks of trade, supported by U.S. naval power, throughout the Western Hemisphere. Rhetorically, as Blaine expressed it at an international conference in Washington in October 1889, just as Douglas arrived in Haiti, such a policy was friendly and unthreatening. Blaine termed the policy enlightened and enlarged intercourse of all. This open trade, though, and especially the American desire to enforce its control over the Caribbean, required naval coaling stations. Neighborly and acquisitive at the same time, such policies embodied the contradictions of an emerging empire. Hippolyte had overthrown Légitime's regime and come to power in a military insurgency, supported in part by U.S. weapons, including 17 Gatling guns provided by an American merchant. A key figure in Hippolyte's new regime was Antinon Fiamine, a lawyer and former schoolteacher from Le Cap in the north of Haiti, an intellectual who had lived and studied in Paris as an expatriate and written an important work of anthropology, The Equality of the Human Races. Fiamine became Hippolyte's Minister of Foreign Affairs and a key player for the next year and a half of negotiations about the U.S. desire to possess Mont Saint-Nicolas. After an awkward wait of some 3 weeks, Douglas finally got his audience with President Hippolyte on November 14th. Douglas wrote officially to Blaine that as Douglas's carriage approached the National Palace in Port-au-Prince, long lines of soldiers saluted as he passed, their officers in brilliant uniforms imparting to the scene quite a gay military aspect. Inside the grounds of the palace, a band played the Star-Spangled Banner with skill and effect. Douglas met Hippolyte, surrounded by his cabinet and trusted generals. Fiamine formally presented Douglas, who delivered a short address. In his description of the scene for his boss back in Washington, Douglas offered a character sketch of the new leader. Hippolyte, wrote the minister, was a man of medium height, of dark brown complexion and gray hair. He has a well-balanced head, a clear, steady eye, a calm temper, and high intelligence. He was evidently a man not to be trifled with. The writer in Douglas could not be completely contained within the formality of diplomatic prose. In his address, Douglas said all the appropriate words about cordial relations and historical friendship. Then he moved quickly to stress modernity. Art, science, discovery, and invention had advanced with such speed as to transcend our ability to keep pace. Steam, electricity, and enterprise could now link the nations of the world in universal brotherhood and interdependence. Growing commerce would mean the enlargement of human sympathies. Before closing, Douglas begged to speak a personal word about the symbolic meaning of his presence. Mine has been a long and eventful life, identified with the maintenance of principles illustrated in the example of Haiti. The former slave from a backwater in a corner of the Upper South did not have to put a name to slavery in front of men who had lived the history of Haiti. In his response, Hippolyte, too, pointed to a common fate for all peoples of the civilized world. But he also trained that steady eye on Douglas and reminded him, as representative of the giant to the north that coveted coaling stations, that every nation has therefore the right to be proud of its autonomy. Hippolyte ended, however, by acknowledging that Douglas himself was the incarnation of the idea which Haiti is following, the moral and intellectual development of men of the African race by personal effort and mental culture. For now, both men could walk away from this formal meeting with pride. In the fall of 1889, the Douglases looked with difficulty for suitable housing in Port-au-Prince. First, they stayed in a hotel, then looked at various rentals, then took a temporary cottage up in the hills above the city. Eventually, they settled in the Lucie Villa, which pleased Helen because of its beautiful gardens. They stayed there until Douglas took a leave back in the United States, beginning in July 1890. In December, when they returned to Haiti after several months, the Douglases, with more local knowledge, found an even nicer residence called Tivoli. Helen again described with near rapture the beauty of the place. Many and many a night, Mr. Douglas would arise, and while others slept, stand beneath the open sky and commune with the stars. Helen was more than equally inspired by the natural surroundings. Eloquently, she declared, "Here I learned the mystery of the dawn and saw the night flee away. Down the mountain it would come audibly. The great banana leaves would begin to stir, and the air would be filled with the sense of life. And lo, great diverging rays of rose and blue, perfect in their symmetry, would fill the east from horizon to zenith." The beauty of Haiti also inspired Frederick. He later characterized the island as wonderfully beautiful, grand, and impressive. Clothed in its blue and balmy atmosphere, it rises from the surrounding sea in surpassing splendor. Douglas also admired Haiti's resources, and therefore commercial potential. He thought it a land of perpetual fertility. Its tropical heat and insular moisture keep its vegetation fresh, green, and vigorous all year round. Its mountains are still covered with woods of great variety and of great value. Its climate, like that of California. He thought the Bay of Port-au-Prince almost as beautiful as the Bay of Naples, and Môle Saint-Nicolas, the Gibraltar of the Caribbean. Inspired by this extraordinary beauty, Douglas nevertheless arose every day to face the complex issues of word-twisting diplomacy. In Haiti, Douglas found himself snared in politics he half believed in but could not fully embrace. He tried to imagine American expansion as humane and ultimately beneficial to Haitians, especially on the issue of the coaling station at Môle Saint-Nicolas, but also on the overall relationship of the two nations. Douglas aimed for what the historian of Haiti, Laurent Dubois, called happy globalization. The benevolent emerging naval giant, presumably still advancing its egalitarian transformations from the Civil War and Reconstruction, would gain its exclusive port in one of Haiti's best harbors. The latest regime in Port-au-Prince would gain stability, prestige, protection, and especially growing commercial ties for its lucrative coffee, sugarcane, and logwood products. In the late 20th and early 21st centuries, Such an approach to foreign affairs became known as soft power, the use of persuasion, not coercion, negotiations and not military action, in the conduct of relations between nations. An early, if unwitting, visionary of soft power, Douglas hoped that words would win over warships. In Antonin Fermi, the Haitian foreign minister, Douglas almost had a like-minded partner in this dual quest. But by December 1889, Fermi asked him to explain why an American warship, Yantic, ostensibly doing scientific work for the laying of a French cable between Haiti and Cuba, was so visible a presence at Mole Saint-Nicolas. The U.S. minister conducted a good deal of correspondence, some of it awkward, with both Fermi and the captain of the Yantic, Commander C.H. Rockwell. On December 9th, Douglas wrote to Blaine with what was, in diplomatic speak, a firm warning. Since so many articles had appeared in the American press, Douglas argued, relative to an alleged purpose of the United States to gain some sort of foothold at the Mole, and in view also of what appears to me to be an extreme sensitiveness of the Haitian people generally on the subject of any possible alienation of their territory, it is but natural that the presence of the Yantic and our naval officers at the Mole should occasion some comment in Haitian circles. Douglas even suggested that this issue could endanger the stability of the Yipoli government. Opponents already accused the president of a plan to sell the country to the Americans. Here began a year and a half of engagement with the central policy contention between the United States and Haiti. For now, the minister did his duty, and he and Helen enjoyed life among the diplomatic corps in Port-au-Prince. On New Year's Eve, 1889, the Douglases attended a gala event at the National Palace. So did some well-dressed American naval officers, led by Rear Admiral Bancroft Gherardi, now Blaine's primary emissary, and soon the U.S. minister's internal adversary in conducting diplomacy in Port-au-Prince. Admiral Gherardi, a Civil War veteran of the Battle of Mobile Bay, had been commissioned by the Navy and State Departments to conduct a thorough study of all possible coaling stations in the West Indies. But during these winter months, financial matters preoccupied Douglas. The condition of the Haitian currency, rumors that European powers would be sending naval expeditions to Haiti to collect debts, and especially a debt of $60,000 dating from 1887 owed to an American citizen, Charles Adrian Van Bokkelen. Under Firmin's pleading, Douglas requested a delay by Blaine and the State Department. By summer 1890, Douglas successfully arranged for payment on installments over 6 years. These kinds of matters seemed at times to consume Douglas, who was no novice about money and persuasion. He frequently referred in his official letters to Washington to the interests of the merchants and capitalists on both sides. But he also reported often on the problems of social order and violence in Haiti. On January 17, 1890, Douglas described the Haitian legislative elections underway as extremely cumbersome and complicated, with voting conducted over 15 days. He acknowledged considerable disorder and violence in some quarters, but not more than occur in some parts of our own country at elections. He was looking for silver linings in an election process where whatever party was in power, he admitted, was accused of improper and undue influences. The presence of soldiers had intimidated some voters, he recognized. But trying to find a diplomatic middle ground, he declared the election, in the main, fair. In February, however, he reported violent unrest simmering in Port-au-Prince. A possible danger to public peace and to Hippolyte's government seemed a daily threat. At this very time, Admiral Gherardi produced his report about the strategic value of Haiti to the United States because of the millions which American citizens are investing in the Nicaragua Canal and our fixed determination to allow no one to gain a foothold on the island. Bassett had warned Douglas of the American desire to build a white man's canal across the isthmus of Central America. Just how to represent that fixed determination of American expansion became the central challenge of the rest of Douglas's tenure in Haiti. In late January 1890, Douglas made an official 2-week visit to Santo Domingo, the capital of the Dominican Republic, to the east of Haiti. He went by sea aboard